You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Miss Khadija Moore to the digital world. Hello.
Welcome, welcome.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, anytime we have these conversations, you know, you're somebody that pops up at the right place, the right time. And you just know, listen, you have always been on point in every conversation. And I think it's time, you know, we had this conversation publicly because 2026, so much has changed and so much is changing. And when you look at, you know, where the global markets are and when you're seeing, you know, all this talk about the future of jobs, new skill sets, you know, new ways that companies are hiring, you know, we still have people that are printing resumes, putting it in the manila folders,
yeah,
and walking into locations looking to hand them out. So, you know, we got to get with the times. And who better to talk to about just the entire change of the workforce than you? So thank you for taking the time and joining us on Digital World. But I'll start off by saying or asking you, you know, when you look at the landscape, you know, between the Caribbean markets and the global markets, you know, what's your take? How do you feel? Are you confident in what's going on? Where do you land on it?
That's such a big question to unpack, Huron. I think that out of the gates with that one is torturous. It's not even fair.
We set the stage. No, we're setting the stage to really then dive in.
Yeah, but I think it's an exciting time. It's an energizing time for World of Work. And I think you can look at it and you can spin the tale of gloom and doom, or you can spin a tale of, you know, having the cup, looking at the glass half full rather than half empty. And I think it's an energizing time. It's a time of lots of opportunities. And I think we have such great talent in the Caribbean that we just need to be positioned to take advantage of it.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Better positioned is kind of my view at this time. Yeah.
No, my thoughts there is, do you think it's a matter of us not knowing our value of what we could bring to the marketplace, or not knowing what is available for the skills that we have here in the Caribbean?
I think it's a bit of both, and it may also be other factors as well. So not knowing the value that we have and that we can bring. I've had the pleasure of working in about 30 different countries globally. We have great talent in the Caribbean. So I have that context. I've seen it live in terms of Caribbean talent versus talent in a lot of different locations. We have great talent. So we may not always be aware, because not everybody has the lens of working across various markets to have the comparison to be aware. So that's definitely a factor. I think in terms of knowing what is available as well is a matter of us doing our homework. And I think not everybody does their homework, right? We need to do our homework. It's a bit of both. And I'm sure that there are other factors that can be teased out that filter and factor in to kind of where we are right now. Absolutely.
From where you sit, as we, you know, Carnival just wrapped up. So in Trinidad, you know, the new year officially starts.
Oh, God.
Right? New year officially starts now. Carnival is wrapped up. People are now getting focused. And I see my DMs fill up every single day with questions around work. There is a lot of concern around the job market. People have PhDs, people have masters, they have all the qualifications. And it's the people with the most qualifications that are usually reaching out to me saying that they're struggling with getting jobs in the local market. And they're trying to figure out, you know, where to go to next. In 2026, what do you think has been the biggest shift in the global workspace that Caribbean people are probably struggling when it comes to getting into where the world of work is today?
That's a good question. So I'm going to start with skills. I think I would say two biggest shifts. I would say skills and maybe leadership and how we approach work. But I'm going to start with skill sets. I think we've kind of, the world has moved away from jobs being extremely fixed and kind of moving more and more towards kind of having liquid skills. And a lot of us are still planning around traditional job architectures, titles, headcount, static job descriptions, when competitiveness is really how fast an organization is able to reconfigure skills, reconfigure teams around priorities that they're chasing towards. So I think as you apply for jobs and you apply for roles, again, doing your homework, and I'm probably going to repeat this a couple of times today. I'm a trainer. My first entry into HR was really around training, right? So I'm going to talk from a trainer's lens. A lot of the time I talk from a trainer's lens. And I think that that is helpful to perhaps the person that is listening in as well. So when you think about applying for jobs, there's this, yes, you have the qualifications, but have you demonstrated on, let's say, your resume, for example, as the first thing that you'll do when you're applying for a job or job seeking is, you know, get your resume out. You're going to update it. You're going to send it in. Can I look at your resume and see the skills and value that you add easily? Or do I see a list of tasks and a list of job titles and a list of educational qualifications? And I think if I can't parse out, so I always tell people, you don't write your resume for yourself. You write your resume to the hiring manager and HR. Yeah. Those are the people who are going to first see it to kind of do that short listing. If it's really difficult for me to tell this person is going to come here and add X value, it's hard to get past that initial step there. So I think if you look at it with a lens of applying for work and that kind of stuff, skills and demonstrable skills really do matter. More than anything else. So I'll stop there. I said two, but I'll give you that one, and we can go from there.
No, that's perfect. And I'll add this in before Curtis comes in. When people tend to reach out, more often than not, when we're thinking about international jobs or remote jobs, we're usually looking for some reason at the bottom of the barrel jobs, for one. But then two, when people ask about jobs in their particular fields, when we look at what some of the companies abroad are looking for, not from a qualification standpoint, but from a skill set standpoint, a lot of it is missing. So for example, one of the big skill sets right now that I'm seeing companies asking for is AI fluency. And you're seeing that in jobs popping up in health, popping up in finance. So if somebody's applying both the same qualifications, both same master's level, but somebody has a skill set for AI versus somebody who doesn't have it, that's a skill set that's going to separate and differentiate you. So yeah, seeing the skills mismatch is something that I'm constantly having to kind of, you know, walk people through or ask people about, because I think that's a huge missing link moving forward.
So I'm going to drill down there a little bit because I think this is important. And I think if people take nothing else, I hope they take what I'll say next. So one, to your point, I think in terms of AI, even if AI isn't on the job description, and let's say you get into the interview, a person who can use it and a person who can't use it may create some separation when you go through the interview stages, right? Not for every job right now, as I said, Caribbean, you're catching up and that kind of stuff, but it will begin to kind of separate you during that process, your ability to use it, build up models, agentic tools, et cetera. It will make a difference. But for not every level, and perhaps not in the way we think right now in the Caribbean, but 6 to 12 months, I'm sure it will continue to go that way. But the other thing is that when you're applying for a job, when people read the job description, I always say, don't just read the job description of the job that you're applying for. Go on LinkedIn. We all have LinkedIn, right? Go on LinkedIn, search that job title on LinkedIn, look for all the other jobs globally that have that job title, right? And look at what are the skills that you're seeing. And if you don't have them, you have homework to do. Right? Have some homework to do, because a job description or a job ad won't capture everything, but the hiring manager and HR know what they're looking for. And if you scan through 10, let's say 10, let's say you sit down at night with a glass of wine and you go through 10 and you write down some notes on what the 10 are, right? And you go from there, you'll be able to say, okay, for these 10 job descriptions, these three skills coming up, I have one of the three. How can I build some bench strength around the other two and update my CV accordingly, update my resume and be able to talk to it competently in an interview? So I think that's important. That's me going off on my trainer's tangent, But let's get back to the conversation.
That's perfect. That's perfect. Curtis.
No, I'm thinking you're on the point of AI. And when we think about AI, this just happened. Let's just think about just about 2 years that it really is something that we all know are talking about or thinking about in our daily lives. How have you seen AI affected the world of work? Is it that it changed the jobs, or is it that it took away jobs, or did it just raise the expectations of companies now when you are doing a job? Where do you see AI right now in the workspace?
I think globally it's changing jobs, but it's also really raising the expectations around productivity and what people are expected to deliver. So I would say expectation inflation right. is where AI is right now for pretty much every role.
That's good.
So I'm not convinced that it's replacing jobs at the level of which we're being told. And if you delve into the research around this, it really does reflect that. Mm. I think we had inflation of staffing, especially going into COVID and coming out of COVID in different sectors. And I think that inflation of staffing, people are being forced to kind of justify, you know, why does that inflation exist? Is it needed? And now AI has added inflation of expectations, right? So it's really raising the baseline for what good looks like.
Wow.
Same role. People want faster turnaround, better insights, things that are more personalized, fewer errors, et cetera. And it's able to do that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It is. And if you're using it, I know most people use it day in and day out. I see it in the organization I work with and other organizations that I consult for. People are using it day in and day out to help them refine their work, et cetera. So it's not exactly a replacement engine. I don't think it's there just yet. I mean, it's forecasted to be, et cetera. I think as it goes on and as people are able to build up more that agentic aspect of AI, et cetera, there will be that impact to some extent. But it's more of a productivity task.
Love that.
productivity task, I should say.
Yeah.
Right? So everyone is kind of expected to do a bit more with a little less.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of the impact that we've been seeing. Or even if not with less, I think the expectations have just kind of grown. Because you do have people across the organizations who are using it and are doing more. And persons who are not using it at that same pace, people are looking at them and saying, okay, so
catch up.
Can you
what
give
are
me
you
more?
Doing?
Yeah. So I think it's that expectation inflation. I think that's the greatest reality that I've seen. I would say global organizations, regional organizations, that has kind of come forth from AI at this time.
Now, Karen, you know what I find to be real funny?
Mm-hmm.
We are coming out of the season where people would have seen the use of AI in work as you cheating. You know what I mean? That you end doing the work. You know what I mean? And we're going into this season where it is, as you just said, it is expectation inflation. People expect that you use. As a matter of fact, if you now hire somebody or somebody hire you and you are not using AI, you are slowing them down. You know what I mean? I like that space.
I'll throw something. Go ahead.
Yeah, before we used to say do your Googles, right? So before you ask obvious questions, go do your Google. So it's a little bit similar with AI, different. And I would say I recently did my executive MBA at Cambridge. And when I first got in there, it's like almost 3 years ago now, persons was like, no, don't use AI for assignments. And, it would be cheating, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then they very quickly put guidelines around how you're expected to use AI for assignments.
Right.
So it's a brainstorming tool, it's not a writing tool. It's
That's
a
right.
refinement tool, but it's not a writing. I think similarly for AI, I don't like when a person sends me a document, I've given you something to work on, and I can see you copy and paste it out of AI.
Gosh. Yeah.
Like, come on, remove the lines from ChatGPT, edit one or two words.
At least.
I think we can refine it a little bit. Don't just drop it there and kind of bring it out. So it needs to be almost like, I don't want to say co-pilot because I don't want to bring Microsoft in, but it needs to be like a co-worker to you or, an assistant to kind of help you get to the outcome.
So good.
I'll throw something out there and I want your feedback on it. Will AI fluency be the new typing? Will it be the new email skill set?
The new Excel.
The new Microsoft Suite.
Computer literacy.
Will AI fluency be that?
Absolutely. All the trends indicate it right now. All the trends indicate as much. I think it will be. I'll, with the exception, let me just put a caveat, maybe a couple of jobs that perhaps, right? But I think in general, it will be. Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
Now, I have a question. So in 2026, what does employable mean today? And how has that changed from 5 years ago?
I love that question. I'm trying to spring my mind back to 5 years ago. It feels almost like a decade ago, to be honest, if not more. But I think two things stand out to me in terms of employable and employability and defining that. I'll give you two phrases, because they're not words, they're two phrases. Mm-hmm. Learning agility and value creation. So I'll explain what learning agility. I was actually doing some training this week and teaching about learning agility to some of our executive teams. And learning agility is really about your ability to take past experiences and apply it into new challenges, new situations, new scenarios. So a person that has really high learning agility, they're not only just trainable, right? There's a person that will come to you and say, Kieran, you know, at my previous job in marketing, this is what we used to do. This is how we approach this particular challenge. This role, this company is a little bit different in this particular way. I think if we flex these one or two things and we execute on this in X way, we are going to improve, I don't know, revenue, impressions, whatever the case may be, right? That's learning agility. You're going to be required to do that a lot more in the right? You have to be able to kind of get in, make an assessment, have a plan of action, and have that autonomy to be able to do it on your own, right? Mm. That's absolutely important. The other part of that is also about proving, creating, delivering value to the business. And I hope my staff aren't tuning now, because if anybody has ever worked with me, they know that this is kind of like my go-to kind of phrase, like, what is the value that you're delivering? Don't tell me tasks. I want to hear KPIs, metrics, outcomes, impact, right? What is the value you're creating in your area? An officer, an assistant, an administrator, coordinator, there's value you can create at that level, right? It's not going to look like the value a manager or director or general manager creates, but there is value that you can create at that level. And you want to figure out, like, what is your secret sauce? What are the KPIs that matter to the business? And how can you use your secret sauce to deliver at your level and create value for the business? And I don't think we're having this discussion enough with our employees and our people, because our parents raised us to go have a job and be in it for 20 years. And once we go to work and we do the right things, we'll move up the corporate ladder. People are expecting value as the world of work continues to evolve. We'll expect value at every level of the organization to be created. That's what employable looks like. And if you have what I call signal strength, so portfolio or metrics or achievements that speaks to that, not just claims, not I think I can do, I'm willing to do, but, you know, at my last job, I did X, Y, and Z. And again, at a very junior level, administrators, assistants, et cetera, you may have one or two things. I don't expect you to come with 10, right? May expect an executive to come with 10, but at a junior level, not one or two things that you've done and you achieved and you're confident that you can bring to the new organization, et cetera. But I think those two things, if you have those two things, you can demonstrate those two things, you're employable. Right? It's just a matter of time till you find the right job, the right company, the right role, et cetera, the right terms, et cetera.
Curtis, before you jump in, those two points are huge. The learning agility, because I think that's one of our biggest challenges right now. If we haven't, we've been doing some of these things for so long, and a lot of the new jobs are so different that people are struggling to be able to take what they've learned in previous jobs and bring it into something new. Make it worse if the company itself is one of those organizations that hasn't been updating and upgrading over time, and they're still stamping things and signing things manually and using snail mail to communicate. But you see that second part about the employability and demonstrating your value.
Yeah.
That's a conversation. Where does somebody even learn that? Because you're never really told how to showcase your value to a company.
Yeah.
Right? And again, as you're saying, I'm thinking throughout like all of my corporate life, even coming from Canada, I might have had like two or three managers that they knew their numbers so well that they could tell you what your value was to the organization. So you kind of had a little bit of insights. Oh, well, that's what they're looking for. You know, okay, this is how, you know, I show my value to the company. But that's not something that I think anybody has ever sat me down, ever told me, or even a conversation that you even see just out in the open. So that's a very, 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 very powerful one.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. I hope people taking notes, you know, because there's a whole masterclass happening right now. I'm all in. My thoughts now go based on what you're just talking about, being able to produce your value or to show value. Now more than ever for companies, it is critical that they hire well. This is not time for them to be making mistakes. Where now do you see? Because a lot of companies are now using AI to help them hire well. Where do you see that balance, or do you support the use of AI in hiring? Should that be part of the whole process, or should you just leave it still open to how they feel inside, how the manager, the hiring agent feels inside? Where do you see that? Where do you stand?
I don't think Khadija has feelings. Khadija, you have feelings on this?
Of course I have feelings. So AI is a great tool. There have been a lot of concerns and risks around AI being used in hiring. And I know a lot of countries are even having some governance protocols put in place around how do you use AI in hiring. I think AI is supposed to be used for augmentation. So going back to the example I just gave when it was at school, you know, it's to be used for X and not Y, and kind of having those guardrails. Guardrails are important. Without guardrails, you'll exacerbate biases, et cetera. So guardrails are extremely important. So I think you use it for augmentation and you have human oversight checkpoints. You have to. I think it's a bit of both. As it evolves, if you trust it and if you have those like clear documentation of how it evaluates and what evaluates and why and that kind of stuff, that you can kind of audit it. Can you let it take a little bit more? Sure. But I think if you're getting started, augment and have human checkpoints. Right?
That's good.
But it is a good tool. Yeah.
Wow.
Now, as we're talking about AI, I think people will realize there's a lot of tech conversations happening in this future of jobs conversation, right? And because we're talking to Khadija, she's giving us some insights as a trainer and as somebody that's working inside of HR. One of the things that most people across the Caribbean have not heard about, but they are victims of, is applicant tracking software, ATS. And whenever the conversation of ATS compliant resumes comes up, it's a deer in headlights conversation. Now, I mean, I know some HR people tell me Caribbean-wide that they are using it or it's coming out into their companies. Most Caribbean businesses, they themselves are probably saying, ATS, what is that? HR? But for the people that are looking for opportunities abroad, bet your bottom dollar, organizations have these things in place. So, Khadija, ATS, what is it? And what do we need to know? Because we are victims. And we don't even know that we are playing the game of HR and ATS, the software. What is it?
So I sit on the side that says ATS doom and gloom stories are perhaps overhyped. That's kind of where I sit. So there are three things that I think people need to do. So applicant tracking systems, they parse the CV. If you put AI into it, it can create your shortlist for you, et cetera. In the Caribbean, though, we have applicant tracking systems, and it's really to like, keep a log of everyone who's applied, having a setup so you can respond and tell people automatically that, that after you've shortlisted, that perhaps we're not looking for you at this time, but we'll keep your resume on file, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a tool. We do use it. But most of my peers, I'm not going to say all, a lot of people, however, still put eyes on CVs to shortlist, even though they have that ability. Some of them have the ability to kind of have it do the shortlist for them, et cetera. I think recruiters, even globally, you put eyes. I mean, if you have 5,000 CVs, that's a different thing. Yeah. You're going to have to have some criteria to sort and go through, et cetera. But if you're getting 50, 60 CVs, for a senior level job, I am going to look at all of them. I'm going to scan all of them just to put that out there. So I think that one, I'm hoping that reduces some level of fear. But it's still important that people, especially applying overseas, where there are probably going to be 10,000 people applying to the same job, understand what you need to do for your resume. And simple as your resume is not a brochure. It is a data set. What do I mean by that? There are three things you want to keep in mind. Formatting is the first one. You want a simple, boring Word format. I've seen people who design resumes do these nice, pretty things with a table on the side and something,
Canva, hello.
And something floating in the middle and, you know, the Canva geniuses. And I love a pretty CV in theory. I think practically a boring CV is what you want.
Wow.
Right? Because it has issues. The machine has issues reading the formatting, the fancy formatting. So if it's simple, it's bullet points, nicely formatted, sophisticatedly formatted, but you want to have something that is simple, Word document, put your name up top, put in all of the things that you would put, but not all the fancy colors and floating stuff, because it's not always read by the machine in the way that you intended to be read or in the way that a human can read it. Okay. Going back to the data set part, so formatting, first thing. Next thing is keywords. You should have keywords that speaks to the job and skills for the job that you're applying for. I think people love to put random, you know, strengths that have really nothing to do for the job. And for the ATS, and even for a skilled interviewer, when you go to an interview and you're saying these things about strengths, et cetera, and they don't closely relate to the skill sets, the expertise, the competence that you want for the job, we do in the interview kind of say, okay, maybe not this candidate, right? So you want to be talking the language of the job that you're applying for. You want to think about the skill sets and the competencies of the job you're applying for. And you want to think about which of those do you have that you can put on the resume to demonstrate that you are a good fit for the job, because we're all looking for fit, right? And then the last thing, I said value earlier, it's value again, but in a different way in terms of just outcomes, right? What are the metrics, the outcomes, the numbers that you move, the impact that you've made, you've demonstrated, how is that captured on your CV? If you're doing those three things, have a strong data set, not a pretty brochure, strong data set, and your resume stands a really good chance, I would say, with the ATS, but also with the person who is going to be doing the shortlisting if it's not ATS as well. Mm-hmm. So I think good practices are good practices.
Now, Khadija is making some very excellent points, because according to a Yahoo Finance article that I was reading, 75% of resumes never actually make it to the recruiter.
Wow.
Simply because applicants don't even realize they have to, or they have the pretty brochure resumes. Mm. And the system itself pretty much disqualifies the resume. So understanding what an ATS resume is, if you don't know what it is, I highly recommend jumping on a ChatGPT just so you can, you know, get some more information, or jumping on Google, just to add to what Khadija was saying. But your resumes should absolutely You should have an ATS version of your resume in case you do have to. And you know, let me ask you this before Curtis jumps in. Khadijah, you know, rule of thumb from what I know, and you're better suited to answer this. If I'm applying to a job board, I would use my ATS version of the resume. But if I'm speaking to an actual recruiter directly, I would send in the pretty brochure. Mm. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. Yeah, so if you're applying through the website, through LinkedIn, it takes you over to the company's website. It's something fancy. You see like a work day or something else like that. They're likely going to be using ATS to scan through, use your ATS resume. And it comes to the first interview and they says, can you send me an updated version of that? It's fine to send the pretty brochure. I mean, if I'm having candidates in person and they want to walk with something printed and it's pretty, I'm happy, yeah. Right? So I'm not saying no to the pretty. You just have to know maybe when and where and it's appropriate.
That's good.
Curtis.
No, if we're bringing this to, or bring it back home into our Caribbean context, do you see Caribbean companies, HR departments, you know, going at the right pace or modernizing at the pace of these global hiring technologies, or are we still way behind? On a scale of 1 to 10, where are we as a region?
I'm not going to answer that on a scale of 1 to 10, Curtis. I'm absolutely not going to do that. You're comparing people's oranges, trees, windows, and something else. I don't think that's not a fair question. that's almost a disingenuous question. So before I actually answer that, I just want to say, I was looking for a tool. I was trying to remember the name of it. jobscan.co. You can drop your CV in there, drop the job you're applying to, the description, and it can match to tell you the likelihood of it getting through the ATS. And I think that, just want to give something practical
that's
to
good.
People.
Job
jobscan.co. Okay. Yeah. There are a couple of tools out there. I mean, you can Google it and find something else that you want to use, but there are tools that can support you in this process. And I know people are applying, so I think that would be helpful. So going to Curtis's question.
Where are we?
I'm not going to answer that on a scale. What I would say is not consistently. Most HR teams have limited or sometimes even no tech stacks, depending on the size of the company. Gotcha. Larger companies do have a bit better tech stack. Gotcha. But these things are extremely expensive. Like, right. I love Workday. I love Gloat. I love all of these fancy modern marketplaces too. Things like internal marketplaces. Gloat is amazing for an internal marketplace. Workday is phenomenal. The budget for these things, Curtis,
out of this world.
Are out of this world. Yeah, and you can't expect the average Caribbean company to afford that just for the sake of scaling at the same pace, or modernizing, I think was your exact word, at the same pace as global companies. Yeah. Like,
It's different.
It's different, but there are tools that can be utilized. You can build your tech stack. It's probably not going to be in the traditional way. You can use tools like Power Automate to automate. You can build up some of your skills taxonomies if it's an internal marketplace that you want to do. There are ways around that, but it requires a lot more elbow grease and hours, blood, sweat, and tears. It's possible, but I think if you compare the average company, don't want to call a company's name, to a really large company that has an amazing tech stack, it's not a fair comparison. And I think that needs to be highlighted.
Yeah, the cost factor to acquire.
Small set of economies.
That's a challenge. That's a challenge that we are going to see in almost every aspect. Mm-hmm. Because even when the conversation of cybersecurity, why aren't more businesses investing in cybersecurity? The solutions, for the most part, are expensive. And then a lot of businesses don't realize, or a lot of businesses in the Caribbean don't think they're at that level where they need the cybersecurity or need to invest in cybersecurity. But again, that's a question that in almost every area of a business and the tech stack that goes with it, you know, are a lot of the smaller to medium-sized businesses in a position to even afford it? And if we're not able to afford it, you know, where does that put us on the global scale? So that's going to be a very interesting angle to look at moving forward. Khadijah, we have about 15 minutes left, right? And I want to get into the conversation that I think is extremely important. degrees and skills, right? This is not a conversation of degrees versus skills. We know we need both, right?
Yeah.
But we need to have an up-to-date context as to what our companies are looking for. Because every day, somebody with a master's reaches out and says, I'm qualified, I can't get the job. But then we have high school dropouts with skills that are getting flown around the world, employed by companies because they have value. They have a skill set that they can employ and do with people, right? There are people that are not having any issues because they have skill sets and a demonstrated portfolio of as to how they can provide value, and they're getting these jobs. Caribbean-wide, though, we still lead with skills. We still lead with skills from a company perspective and what we're looking for. And even when people are presenting themselves, they present themselves with degrees first. So is there a shift that we need to have in the Caribbean? Is there a conversation in terms of how do we balance the hiring in looking for skills versus degrees? Because I think we still have a lot of companies that are so degree heavy, but then you get the person and they don't have the skills. And if we're coming from an educational standpoint where a lot of the things that we need are not even being taught, we're spinning top in mud, you know? How do we strike that balance moving forward?
Another big question. You're hitting me hard today, Kieran, but I love it. So let's break it down a bit. I think degrees are essential. Universities are essential. Statistically, degrees continue to have the greatest impact on economic outcomes. That's a fact. That's a statistic. That's something we can't get away from. I don't think you introduced me as a Barbadian, but as a Barbadian, one of the things that we take pride in, and I think for all Caribbean people, I know Jamaica, Trinidad also have a UE, is that we say free education up to tertiary level. It's heavily subsidized, and it has allowed us to have some of the economic outcomes in the Caribbean that we've had coming out of independence, et cetera. And I don't think that could be glossed over. I think that's really important to highlight. Get a degree. I'm not sponsored by UE, okay? But that's important to highlight. However, right? Actually, before I go to however, so degrees in universities, we don't use them in the way that we should use them, or we don't always think about them, rather, in the way we should think about them. Universities should equip us with critical thinking skills, foundational skills across. So I did a business degree, international business master. So we did all the aspects of business, which gives you systems thinking, which is important, like one of the most critical skills that you'll have, especially if you want to grow in your career, et cetera. So it builds the foundation, sets you up with critical thinking, gives you a really strong base. So having a degree for a professional job, I don't want to say entry level, let's say a senior officer type role, mid professional level, just before manager and manager and above, I can see why people will put it down, right? It's not the be all and end all, and I want to be very clear on that. Demonstrable skills are extremely important, but degrees set the foundation. Degrees let you have a solid economic outcome for you, your family, et cetera. So that's the way we need to think about degrees. In the world of work, and in the world of work today, we also need to think about university degrees or degrees in general and skills as a bit of blended readiness. So both and rather than either are, but demonstrable skills are and really should trump the degree. Because if a person has working experience, they can demonstrate that they can do the job. And you have the tools in place to assess this, because not everybody, every company does, right? Assess competencies, capabilities. I see more and more Caribbean companies, I would say this, using things like case studies and case evaluations, assessments to really analyze the skill set. And I think that's a realization that having a degree doesn't give the skill set. And that's the that's a theme that I've seen across a number of companies, and sometimes even really small companies. And people tell me they're prepping a case, and they're reaching out for me to support. I'm like, you're prepping a case, but wow. So there's some rigor that's going into the process to make sure the person I'm bringing in has that fit. So I think that blended readiness is important, and you want to make sure you're pairing your degree and your with things like micro-credentials, work-integrated learning. You have a portfolio of your achievements, accomplishments, and things that you've done to give you the best chance in the market. And I'm hoping I'm answering your question, because I feel like I've danced around a little bit.
No, a
both and situation, and we're going to have to get into the habit of updating. I would say every year. I know people are not going to want to hear it, but I think it's important. Every year, I kind of have two or three certifications or short courses or things that I'm going to do to keep myself on pace with what is happening around the world of work. So people who have masters, and your master's was 10, 15, I want to say, God forbid, 20 years ago, and you send in your CV and there's nothing that indicates that there's been that continuous learning and certifications, et cetera, the fear may be, and that may be the wall you're butting up against, that your skill sets are not as up to date as needed for the role that you're applying to. So I think you really have to go at these things and these situations on a case by case basis, because I really don't want to speak in a blanket way. But I think they're both and for this approach, blended readiness for the job market today. And I would say that I see a lot of Caribbean HR practitioners delving into validating the skill sets and being very clear on the skill sets. I don't think we've moved away. I know some in the US companies move away from just putting a degree. They will say degree or 15 years of experience, or master's degree, 15 years of experience, or they'll just say 15 years of experience, 10 years of experience, these particular skills. I don't think we've gone fully that way as yet. And I don't think there's any harm in that, because the average HR person knows to look at a CV that has a solid set of skill sets, experience, etc., and consider that person and shortlist that person. So it really has to be both and, but demonstrable skills are going to be critical.
I think that's extremely important to highlight, because we are seeing some of the biggest companies in the world, from the IBMs, the Apples, the Teslas, the Googles, the Alphabet company, that have dropped university degree requirement. However, right, and I mean, every time we talk about this on LinkedIn, the degree crowd, you know, runs in and starts to defend degrees. But here's the thing. The companies, it's not like the company is just hiring any and anybody off the street to come in and develop AI. No. Demonstrated skill sets and portfolios are rising. Yeah. And when you can have that demonstrable skill sets and you have that portfolio and you can prove your value to a company, you know, that's what they're taking you as. They know you can do the job. And again, if you have that portfolio, that is getting you in the door a lot faster, or at least getting you conversations with the HR people, where to the point where you're being headhunted and you're not the one that is you're not the one that's going through the process of applying for the jobs, you know, which Curtis, allow me to just follow up with that, because it just came to my mind. At what point does, when personnel build a brand, and you as an HR person are now in the headhunting, you know that you're looking for a particular role and you got to fill it. So you know you've posted a job online, so you're getting in the people that are applying in through the regular channels. But then what are you looking for now when you see somebody that is building a personal brand in that respective space and they have the skill sets and you're seeing it on Front Street, on LinkedIn? You know, how does HR approach that now, versus one angle you're looking at traditional people are applying through the websites, and then you're now seeing somebody who is exactly what you want, but they're posting their content and you as the HR are now like, oh my God, this person would actually be perfect, and you now want to headhunt them. Like, what does that conversation look like, or how does that process look like in today's day and age? Because I don't think you guys were evaluating employee brands, you know, 10 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's, again, it's a both and, right? So even if you send your resume in and we get down to a short list, most HR professionals are going to do a Google, right? And see, you know, what comes up. And your LinkedIn or Instagram is likely going to come up really first, unless you have like some portfolio work, newspaper articles or something like that, that rises higher in the feed, right? And you're going to go and you're going to see, and you're going to look and see what's there. And it matters. And I would say, again, both. And so if you get the resume, you're going through that route. But we also, for roles, I would say that you want to headhunt for, whether it be strategically, quietly, roles that may be hard to fill. Again, you're going to likely go to LinkedIn and you're going to search. So if you persons have a strong brand presence, they have the skill sets and you can find it on their profile, it benefits you, right? I would say that three jobs I've had, including this one, only two of them I've been headhunted for, right? I've not really actively applying for jobs. And I don't even think my LinkedIn presence is the strongest, but it's there. You can tell what I do. You know what I do. You can find me. And I think it matters in today. Not every job is advertised, and that's a fact. I think people want a lot more transparency, and companies are trying to advertise everything more. And if we want to do internal advertisements to give staff the options for internal mobility, then we go externally, and there's that cadence. But at the end of the day, headhunting is real, right? Especially senior to executive level. I may not headhunt for an administrator role, an officer role, et cetera. But if we're talking about senior managers, directors, I expect you to have a presence on LinkedIn. I expect to see what I'll get from you via that presence on LinkedIn. So a nice little write-up doesn't have to be 100 posts. I don't want you to be posting every day, right? But something that allows me to understand who you are and the value that you can create for a business. So it does matter. Yeah, helps.
No, my question is concerning where do you see the responsibility for preparation for the job market? Do you see it being that push that the organizations, the universities, upskill or refresh or update their programming or their degree programming to make sure that people are actually prepared? Or as you just mentioned, when you finish, you constantly update yourself with short courses. Now, I ask that because it's somewhat compared to back in secondary school where you are preparing for CXC or whatever the case is you're preparing for, but you're still going to do lessons at the side so you can actually pass. When really and truly lessons should not be needed, it should be, the school should be competent enough. Do you think that the courses or the degrees has a responsibility to be updating, or is it the responsibility of the individual to prepare themselves?
It's a shared responsibility. I think that's the short answer. The individual, I have to own my career.
Yeah.
And I think that's the change from perhaps expectations that were set, I want to say decades ago, et cetera. Individuals need to own their career because people are moving around from organization to organization to organization. If you were staying there for 25 years, I think, yes, there's a greater onus on the organization. If everyone was staying there for 25 years, right? But that has shifted. And as people, I think we should own our careers. So there's an onus, and I think the onus starts with me. However, the corporations do have a part to play in that responsibility. Universities and those offering degrees, micro-credentialing, et cetera, also have a part to play, because if I am looking for a micro-credential, it should be up to date, right? So if I'm owning my career and I'm going to search and go do my Googles, do my homework to find something that I can do to upskill and reskill myself, universities, institutions, etc. should have materials that are up to date. So I think they have a responsibility. From a corporate perspective, the organization also has a responsibility to make sure that there are resources for the employees that are available. There's coaching for the employees, support, tools, et cetera. So it really is a shared responsibility. And I think it would be unfair to individuals, unfair to organizations, and unfair to universities to put
all of that,
on one area or another. Yeah.
That's so good.
You know, we have two more questions before we wrap up. And you know, following up with that question, last year, the United Nations, they held a conference in Antigua. And part of that conference, they were talking about the migration out of the Caribbean, right? And they were saying that by 2027, the Caribbean is on pace to have the largest diaspora relative to population size by 2027. And the number one driver out of the Caribbean was job opportunities. Whew. Now, I know if you had a magic wand, there would be a lot more that you could do. But I want your take. When I see jobs in my respective space in the Caribbean, the first thing that comes to my mind is I am not going to work for any of these companies, right? But a lot could be said.
That's half full, but go ahead.
I know. I mean, we're having a conversation because it's glass half full and we're trying to get better, right? But the point is, the UN says the number one reason that people migrate out of the Caribbean is for job opportunities. A lot of the job opportunities that we do see for a lot of different industries just don't make no sense, and we just end up, whether it's applying for jobs remotely and we work for a company abroad, or we just outright migrate and put ourselves in a better situation. What do you think we got to start doing to better the local job market? And again, I don't expect you to have all the answers, but what are some things that we could start to do? It's 2026. We have to retain talent. Like, if we have any hope of building a better Caribbean, we got to retain talent. What are some of the things the regional job market can do to start, you know, building a better job market to retain our talent?
Again, it's a hard question.
You're the only person I could ask these things to.
You asked this with a minute to go in the show. I don't know.
Don't worry. Take your time.
No worries at all.
So I think this is a big question. And I think there are a lot of players that needs to be involved in this particular question. I think let's talk about companies and what companies can do. I think you can't talk about what companies can do unless you look at the economy and perhaps how government is being either an enabler or accelerator of the economy, because companies are constrained by the markets, people they serve, the revenues that they generate, etc. So I think we have to be realistic in our approach. And I think there are a couple of things that we can go here. But let's go to, maybe let's start with companies in terms of how we can, what can we do? I think there's that shared responsibility again for us to really, we have great talent. We have solid companies across the region. We have quite a number of multinational corporations. For us to really rise to the occasion and see, okay, how can I operate at a global level in my company in my way? We talked about the constraints of scale, et cetera, or not having scale rather, and realistically, how much can we spend? We're going to need to be more agile in our approaches and rethink the way that we do things. But I think that we can compete globally in the Caribbean. I really do believe that at my core. I believe in our people at my core, right? And you told me to take my time, so I'm going to step back a little bit and talk about a trip I had to Nigeria at the mid to end of last year. And I think that was really eye-opening for what they're building there. At scale, they have the benefit of scale, they have the benefit of creating a product and being really competitive because they have markets of scale, but they're also taking very different approaches to how they do things, right? So we went to a lot of like financial services, et cetera, and the solutions that they were generating were not the Visa and MasterCard and utilizing their sources. They were building their own platforms. Now, that's not my recommendation. I think it's a comparison and how we need to think across the region about how do we compete globally? In what areas do we want to compete at a global level? Because we can't compete at a global level across everything, right? So we're going to have to be strategic and say, okay, this is what I want to do world class. This is how we're going to achieve it world class. This is the frameworks, agile, the pipelines, the people, et cetera, that we'll use to really drive that. So I think thinking about it maybe from a niche excellence standpoint, because we don't have scale, it's going to have to be the niche areas that we really target and really elevate in terms of competing globally. I think I want to say government, I hate saying government, but I think we put a lot on the government, on our governments, right? And I think we need to be mindful of how much and how realistic our expectations of them are as well. Same way I'll say have realistic expectations for companies, we need to do the same for our governments. But I really think that we need to think about how they enable and accelerate business across the region. And I think we need to be having discussions about what are some shared regional standards that we need to have to move business forward at the same pace. I cover 14 countries across the Caribbean. We call them about 6 or 7 markets, right? So OECS kind of being a market, Trinidad, Guyana, Jamaica, Barbados, Belize, Dutch Caribbean, etc. And in every single market, there are extremely nuanced ways of working and conducting business, which also inhibits abilities to scale, abilities to drive value, abilities to create opportunities. And it's a barrier. It's not the only barrier. And again, I don't want to
speak, but it's a barrier.
But it's a barrier that I think that we have. And I think we need to think about how do we modernize digital infrastructure, whether it be digital public services? What's the accelerating and enabling role of our governments and institutions across the region to really meaningfully move business forward and allow us to compete? The last thing that I'll say on this, because I know it's the last question, but I think it's important to really touch on this, not as doom and gloom, but as glass half full again. And I really think that's important. I really want to have constructive discussions rather, that move the Caribbean forward. At where we are right now in AI, everyone is talking about that next great divergence, where AI is increasingly acting as a catalyst for widening social, economic, and global gaps. If there's ever a time for us to kind of, I don't want to say hop on the trend, that's not it, but take advantage of technology and AI and really work in a consolidated, cohesive way to move the needle forward for the region, it is now, right? It is now. The upside, if we do, is really having not just the right workforce, right people, right opportunities, great economic gains, but we can also perhaps export things like high-value services. We talk about our foreign exchange. I've seen some recent reports about foreign exchange and what we need to do. And Trinidad is not in a unique, well, it's in a unique situation, but it's not the only one in that situation, right? So we need to talk about productivity and how do we drive that in innovation, et cetera. And I think AI can be that catalyst. And if we take advantage of it and if we look at, okay, what do we want to do to really elevate the Caribbean in this time and at this juncture, where timing is important, right? We talk about preparation and doing your homework and all that stuff, but timing matters too, right? Timing and what they call luck, right? That does matter. And I think it's important that we have these conversations now. I've been hiding from interviews for the last year plus. I don't think I've done an interview in maybe three years at this point. I've really just had my head down, but I think I couldn't say no because it's a conversation that we really need to be having for the benefit of our people. And we have great people in the Caribbean region. And I want to see us do justice to our people and to the space.
You said a lot there that was extremely critical. And here's the thing, right? To echo your sentiment about the Caribbean having great people, we know we have great people because the rest of the world acknowledges us. When you do great, the first thing, if you do amazing in school, you're presented with a scholarship to the UK, to the US, to Canada, and that talent is plucked. The UN in that same conference last year finished off the conference with something extremely powerful that they wanted everybody to sit with. When you are educating your nation for exportation, that's a race to the bottom. So when you are educating, all right, we have the talent. We have amazing people. We have people competing in the Olympics. We have people who are doctors around the world. We have people doing amazing things. But when you are educating a nation to export that human capital, it's a race to the bottom. So how we retain our people in 2026 moving forward, now that the digital world is here and somebody does not have to leave the region to export their expertise and skills, so they could easily go and get a job online and never work for any company locally, we really have to figure out how to retain our talent, because if we don't, yeah, we're going to run into some real, real problems moving forward. And it's going to be bad. But the talent is there. I would love to see more cooperation from CARICOM. You know, being in Thailand now and seeing how ASEAN operates, where they really do operate as a bloc, the applications that they develop, the system that they develop, they all think everything has to be cross borders. That way you have scale. And I mean, it also helps that you have China and India next door. You know, a tool like Grab, a tool like Alipay. These are services that scale all across Asia. But again, their focus is on development as a block. And that's something that CARICOM has to do. So I love your answer. It's a focus that we absolutely need to start thinking about in 2026. Curtis, I'll let you have the final question.
Well, I think my thoughts now, in the seat that you sit, Khadija, when you look towards the next 5 years, what is one thing that you're most hopeful for to see come out of our Caribbean context?
I think exactly, pretty much my answer to the last question, that we work as a region, that we build more businesses here, we create more opportunities for our people. Good. We compete at the global level. I think it's within reach. I think it's possible. Kieran talked about how much great talent we have, and all of it may not be sitting in the Caribbean, but we have great talent, and email exists, right? I mean, we're in the age of AI. So, I mean, we can bring them, we can work with them. Mm. I think that I'm actually energized for the next 5 years. I think we're in a unique position, and I would like to see us really harness it, take advantage of it, and make the most of it for the betterment of the entire region.
So good.
Wow. Khadija.
Thank you.
This was good. And again, very important, because it's when you are exposed, and I think we had spoke about this some time ago, exposure matters, right?
It does.
Exposure matters. And when you see how some of these companies are operating, you know, before the show, I was talking about, you know, tourism. We just released our tourism numbers for Carnival. We spent $137 million and we got 37,000 people. That same week in Thailand got 4.5 million people, over 30,000 flights. We really need to see how are the best of the best executing in different areas and really figuring out, you know, what can we learn and what can we bring back. You know, me just being here and seeing how these things are operating for myself, you know what we could bring back, right? But we need more of our region to get out. Don't just stay in our home country. Don't just stay in the home city. You've had the benefit of doing schooling out in the UK. So you spend some time, you travel a lot. And I'm sure that has had a humongous impact on your career, your thought process, and your trajectory. You know, I'll always advocate for people that if you have the opportunity to not just vacation, don't just vacation and go and resort. But I really believe that everybody in the Caribbean, if you ever get the opportunity to spend a year away from the entire Caribbean region, could be in Europe, UK, wherever it is, you know, and if you can do that time in your industry, there's a lot to soak in. There's a lot that you could bring back, because we have no shortage of problems and challenges. But every problem and challenge is an opportunity to create the solution for that. Khadija, what are your closing remarks for the Digital World family?
My closing remarks are, do your homework, do your Googles, upskill yourself, take advantage of the opportunities that are out there. You talked about just now about the best practices that exist. There are models that exist. I'm not asking you to reinvent the wheel, but really look into what are the best practices in your field, in your area, and take just one step. At the end of my trainings, I always tell persons, I've taught you a lot. We had 2 hours, 4 hours here doing whether it be management, leadership training, executive training, etc. I don't want you to feel like you need to do 10 things differently tomorrow. But what's one step, one thing that you can do differently, and based on all that we've discussed, that can make a difference over the next year to 10 years of your career and of your life. And just do it. Just do it.
I love it. I think the key actionable takeaway from your speech today that stuck with me, that I would tell everybody, is look at your job or the field that you want to get into. Look at that on LinkedIn. Look at jobs around the world. Look to see what their skill sets are. Look to see what their education is like. Look to see where you are lacking and start to chart a course towards getting those skill sets or getting those micro certifications or getting those degrees. You know, don't just limit yourself to what's available locally, but really look at what is happening globally within your respective space. Because if we are going to start to generate more foreign exchange, if we want to tap into more opportunities, keep in mind, folks, we are a SIDS. We are a small island developing states. We're a collection of them. There's only so many jobs. There's only so much money going around in our economies unless we are creating value and bringing in that revenue from other markets. Remote jobs can definitely help. You freelancing or, you know, taking those skill sets and going at it yourself can create value and bring those monies in. But we got to take advantage of what's available to us right now. And as Khadija started off by saying, she is energized.
Yeah.
You have every right to look at the glass half full, because there are opportunities that you have never even heard about that could be unearthed by a quick Google search, or one ChatGPT session could change the entire dynamic for you moving forward. So, you know, thank you for the conversation today, Khadija. This was a wealth of good information, and I hope that everybody took at least one thing and they can go and implement it. Where can people find you if they want to keep abreast on the content, Miss Forbes Council Girly? Where can we find the content and information? I'm jealous.
Oh, the best place I would say is LinkedIn. I'm active on LinkedIn. Reach out on LinkedIn if you have questions. I don't always get to everybody in the most timely way because people do reach out quite a bit. But LinkedIn is the best place to find me. And it's just my name in a Google search, in a LinkedIn search bar. And yeah, that's the best place.
Thank you, Khadija, for taking your time and joining us on Digital World.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, Kieran. Thanks so much, Curtis.
Thank you.
You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5. 106.5.